So let's look at the beginning of writing in the ancient world. In the ancient world, books were copied by just writing another copy by hand. That was the only way to do it. Now, this technology had certain consequences. First of all, anyone who knew how to read and write could copy a book about as efficiently as anyone else. It's true that if you spent all day writing, you could probably do it somewhat faster. But it doesn't take that long to get practiced up and get efficient. There's no particular economy of scale. Making 10 copies of the same thing is going to take you 10 times as long as making one copy. And therefore, there's no reason for copies to be made in large batches that are identical. Instead, copies were made by one in quantity one whenever somebody wanted a copy of a certain book. And they could be made anywhere. There was no reason for all copies of one particular book to be made in a particular place and shipped around to everywhere else. Instead, anyone who had a copy could just copy it if he wanted to. Because this technology did not force identical copies, there wasn't the same total gulf between copying a book and writing a book in the ancient world. Now, they did understand the idea of an author. They knew, for instance, that a certain play was written by Sophocles. But in between those two extremes, copying a book and writing a book, there were intermediate possibilities that were also useful. For instance, you could start copying a book and then every so often add some more text of your own. And that was writing a commentary, and it was considered a useful and admirable thing to do. And some commentaries became very popular and were highly regarded. You could also write something and then copy part of a book and then write some more new text and then write a copy of part of another book and keep on doing that. That was making a compendium, and that was also considered a laudable and useful thing to do. In fact, there were ancient books that are lost, but sometimes large parts, survive where they were included in compendia. As far as I can tell, there was no idea of copyright in the ancient world. I can't find any sign of one. Anyone had the right to copy any book, although I suppose there were times when there was censorship for political reasons, and you might get in trouble for copying and circulating certain specific books for that reason. Should I use this to wipe it up? Should I? Okay. Well, I mean, I don't know if it's meant for that purpose or for some other purpose or what. Anyway, copying technology advanced with the introduction of the printing press. The printing press made it much more efficient to make copies of books, but it did not improve efficiency uniformly for all possible kinds of copying. There were certain constraints in order to use a printing press efficiently, because it took a lot of work to set the type, but once you did that, making many identical copies from that type was very quick. So the result is that the printing press made it very efficient to make a large number of identical copies of the same text. And this had several consequences. It meant that typically, first of all, the printing press was an expensive piece of equipment, not only the press itself, but also the type that you were going to use with it. So which meant that most people who were literate did not have one. Only a few specialized businesses could do this efficient copying. And second, it meant that copies of any given book were typically produced in just a few places, and shipped to wherever people wanted them. In fact, for the first few centuries of the printing press, some books continued to be copied by hand. This was typically done either by very rich people or by poor people. The rich people probably didn't do it themselves. They paid somebody else to do it and illuminate the copy and make it very beautiful, more beautiful than a mere printed book, to show how rich they were. And the poor people did it because, as the song goes, time ain't money if all you've got is time. There were some people who couldn't afford a printed book, but did have the time to copy one by hand. But in between, for the most part, you know, books were then copied by printing press because that was more efficient. Copyright, as far as I can tell, is a creature of the printing technology, the printing press technology. The earliest copyright reference I've come across is from 16th century Italy. Apparently, you could ask some potentate to give you a monopoly on printing a certain book, and they might do it or they might not. I believe that Italy was a major center of printing for all of Europe at the time. Now, copyright, when it was introduced in Britain, was initially a means of censorship. You had to get permission to publish a certain book, permission meaning that the government was happy with whatever you said. But the ideas evolved, and eventually copyright was redefined as a means of promoting authorship. When the U.S. Constitution was drawn up, there was a proposal that authors should be entitled to a copyright. This proposal was rejected. Now, that may shock you because you've probably heard many publishers tell you that this is the case. But it was, in fact, rejected, and I believe that idea has been traditionally rejected in the UK as well. The idea that was adopted officially in the US Constitution was that copyright exists as a way of getting more books to be written for the sake of the public benefits that result from more authorship. Benefits described as the progress of science. That's literally what it says in the US Constitution as the justification for having a copyright system at all. The copyright system is not mandatory. It's optional. It says Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science. The idea is that if more books are being written, we benefit not only from being able to read more books, but also from the conversation of ideas that's going on. And so for the sake of this public benefit, we trade away part of our natural rights to make copies of anything. So copyright is thought of as a bargain. Now, I'm not an expert on the philosophy of copyright in British law, but I believe it's at least basically similar. It's thought of as an artificial incentive, not as a natural right of anyone. Now, the copyright bargain in the age of the printing press was arguably a beneficial one for the public. And the reason was that the public was trading away a freedom that it lacked the means to exercise. If you didn't have a printing press, you couldn't copy books except once in a while with a pen and ink. And nobody tried to enforce copyright against the occasional handmade copy. It was understood as an industrial regulation. It was a regulation on publishers. And this character of an industrial regulation made it fairly painless. It meant that the activities of ordinary readers were not restricted at all. So they weren't really losing anything. You know, the only freedom you were trading away was the freedom to be a publisher and publish whatever you like. So really, unless you chose to be a publisher and bought yourself a printing press, it made no difference to you at all. Another consequence of this situation was that copyright was fairly easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced against publishers. And one thing about publishers is they have to advertise what they're publishing. So you don't have to snoop on people to find out who's infringing copyright. You just say, see who says he's publishing what. And another consequence is that you didn't need terribly harsh punishments. You just needed to allow someone to sue them, and ordinary size punishments would bring about compliance with the law. And if copyright, to the extent copyright brought about more authorship, a greater conversation of ideas, it may have been an advantageous system overall in the age of the printing press. If you have something that you cannot use and somebody offers to take it off your hands, even for a small fee, it's still a good deal. What can you lose? So, if we were still in the age of the printing press, I wouldn't be criticizing that system. But things began to change. First of all, printing press technology got even more efficient to the point where even poor people didn't have to copy books by hand very much. That was, I believe, in the late 1800s that happened. And after that, people sort of forgot about the idea that anyone might ever copy a book except on a printing press, except as part of industrial production. And the result was that people thought of copyright, they didn't quite understand that copyright was just an industrial regulation. There was no example of anything else to focus people's attention on that difference. And then the age of the printing press itself began to give way to the age of the computer network, a transition that we're still in the middle of, but where we can already see a lot of the consequences. Now, basic principles of ethics cannot be changed by mere changes in technology. They're too deep to be reached or touched by things like that. But when we look at any particular ethical question, the decision among certain possible alternatives depends on the practical consequences that each one of them is likely to have. And that depends on the situation we are in. So changes in the context, including the technological context, can alter the consequences of the same set of alternatives and thus alter the decision we should make. That's what's happening here. Digital information technology is beneficial because it makes it easy to copy and manipulate information. That's why we want to use it. There are those who don't want this to be easy for all of us. Publishers, in particular, do not want computer users to get the full benefit of the power of their computers. They don't want us to get the advantage of being easily able to copy and manipulate information. They want to continue the monopoly that the printing press technology gave them. The way they put it is that computer networks or computer technology in general create problems for copyright. They've been saying that for about 25 years. I'd put it the other way around. Copyright creates problems for the users of computer networks. Because computer technology brings us back to a situation more like the ancient world. Computer technology makes it more efficient to make copies. But again, just as the printing press made it more efficient, but not uniformly more efficient, it was biased towards certain things, towards mass production of identical copies in one place. Well, the computer network gets rid of that bias. With computer technology, anybody who can have something on his or her computer can also copy it and can make a copy that's as good as any other copy that anyone else might possibly make. So we're back to a situation like the ancient world where anyone who can use a work could make more copies and can do so reasonably efficiently, even in quantity one. There's no longer an inherent economy of scale, and there's no longer an inherent need for centralization of production of copies of any one thing. So we're back to a situation where copyright didn't fit. It didn't fit in the ancient world, and it doesn't fit any better today. Let's look at some of the consequences. Well, copyright used to be, in the age of the printing press, fairly painless, easy to enforce, and arguably beneficial. It was painless because it didn't restrict ordinary readers. It only restricted publishers. But now that ordinary readers can copy, and now that people have forgotten the idea that copyright was meant to be an industrial regulation, copyright is taken to restrict ordinary readers, ordinary users. It's no longer painless. Copyright is no longer easy to enforce. It was easy to enforce in the age of the printing press because it only had to be enforced against publishers. But now, the publishers want to enforce it against you and me. And that means intruding into everyone's house. That means draconian punishments. In the US 10 years ago, it was not a crime to make copies of something and hand them out to your friends just to be nice. Then in 1996, it was made a felony. You can be put in prison for years for sharing with your neighbor. And if that's not bad enough, an MP in Britain has proposed a 10-year punishment, even for copying just to share with your friends. I don't know the name, sorry. We can look it up somewhere. And finally, the benefit from copyright is not likely to be what it was. You see, if you have been producing a sort of byproduct of your activities that's useless, so you sell it to somebody for some low price because you might as well, and then you discover a way to use some of it yourself, what are you going to do? You're going to cancel that deal. You're not going to sell it all anymore. Maybe you'll still sell part of it, but you're going to keep the part that you want to use. Why sell something that you value for a low price? So the obvious thing for us to do to change the copyright bargain now that we can make copies ourselves, is we should stop trading that right away to anybody else. Well, maybe we'll still trade part of that right and get something in return. But we obviously will want to keep some of that right and exercise it ourselves. That's what we would do to the copyright bargain now if the public were sovereign. If the public were being allowed to choose what kind of copyright bargain it finds advantageous, it would choose to keep some of the freedom to copy things and exercise that freedom. We see this because people do it whenever they get half a chance. You know, when you see tens of millions of people using something like Napster, it becomes very clear people want to keep this freedom and exercise it. However, we do not have a government of the people, by the people, for the people, not in the US, not in the UK, and not just about any country I can think of. We have governments of the people by the flunkies for the corporations. And among the corporations that are very well organized are the publishing businesses, publishing in a broad sense, including various kinds of media. And so they have been purchasing laws that extend copyright power in unprecedented ways. It give laws that give them more power over the public than they ever had before. The exact opposite of what makes sense for the public's interest. Now, there are various dimensions of the extent of copyright that can be adjusted. One of these dimensions is the length of time that a copyright lasts. Another dimension, which can be further broken down, is which activities does it cover? Copyright has been extended tremendously in both of those dimensions. First of all, there's a dimension of time. Some decades ago, I think copyright in the U.S. lasted some 50 or so years. It's now been extended to the point where it can easily last 150 years. The last extension was interesting because it was passed in 1998, about 20 years after the previous copyright extension, and it extended the term of copyright by 20 more years. People started to figure out what the publishers were up to. You see, the U.S. Constitution says that copyright has to last for a limited time. So they couldn't pass a law saying that copyright is now perpetual, but that's what they wanted. So they came up with perpetual copyright on the installment plan, where every 20 years they pass another law extending all the old copyrights by 20 more years. The result is, if you look at any particular time, any given work is nominally going to go into the public domain eventually. But in fact, as long as this procedure is repeated, no work will ever go into the public domain again. The UK does not have the benefit of a constitutional, well, it doesn't have a written constitution, of course, and so it doesn't have a constitutional requirement that copyright must be for a limited time. And I'm told that a perpetual copyright for Winnie the Pooh has been enacted with the supposed justification that the royalties are going to some kind of charitable organization. But this is perfect as a precedent to get perpetual copyright for everything else, which will not even ostensibly be for the benefit of anyone but a publisher. I'm sure that some particular publisher is benefiting more from that perpetual copyright than that charitable organization is. So, the length of time that a copyright lasts is one important dimension. And in fact, the Supreme Court recently agreed to hear a case about whether that Copyright Extension Act is legitimate. It was named after Congressman Sonny Bono, who was a pop star and then joined the Church of Scientology. And you may have heard that the Church of Scientology uses copyright to suppress dissemination of information about the church and its doctrines. And so they had their congressman get on to the appropriate committee and propose a bill to extend copyright. Well, he died, and his widow was designated to serve out the rest of his term and said that he really believed that copyright should be forever. So we're not just speculating about what they want. The other dimension is, what should copyright cover? Which activities should remain part of the public's rights to use copyrighted works, and which activities should be considered copyright infringement? Now, it may come as a surprise, but copyright in the past was never supposed to be total control over all uses of the copyrighted work. There were certain things the public was allowed to do. And these included things such as selling the copy to someone else or lending it to someone else. This has been, I believe, to some extent restricted in the UK, but not in the US. And of course, the right to keep it as long as you like and read it as many times as you want. And another thing that we don't think of as an explicit right, but that in fact we all have taken advantage of, which is the right to buy a book paying cash and not giving your name, so that no bookstore or anything else has a record of which books you have bought, a record that might be used as part of a witch hunt for political dissidents. Of course, they would be called terrorists. That's the new fashion. When you're attacking dissidents, you call them terrorists. The publishers don't want us to have those freedoms. And they came up with a plan to get rid of those freedoms. Well, they couldn't, even in the US, they couldn't, you know, even despite the tremendous clout that business has with US legislators, they couldn't have passed a law explicitly prohibiting people who owned books from doing those things. There would have been too much outcry. So they came up with a two-step plan. First, they would take away those freedoms for e-books. And they figured they could do that because nobody, there were no e-books. Nobody was a, there were no readers of e-books, so nobody was going to complain. Hardly anybody would even notice. They figured so they'd be able to get that law through without opposition. And then they would switch people from printed books like those and these over to e-books. And they figured people would try out e-books, and they'd see that they had these restrictions, that you didn't have the same freedom as with printed books, but nobody would ever have a choice about that. So they figured people would switch, you know, most people not really be caring much about freedom or being willing to fight for it at all. They figured people would just sheepishly switch, and ultimately they would have succeeded in taking away those freedoms from book readers through this two-step plan. Well, we've been temporarily saved because e-books failed for other unrelated reasons. Apparently, people just didn't want to buy them. Maybe it's because it's not convenient to read things on a computer screen. It doesn't look good. I'm not sure of what all the reasons are. In any case, it failed, but it failed accidentally. It didn't fail because people were up in arms about the restrictions being imposed on them. At least, not that I can see. And that means we can't rely on it to fail always in the future. If it failed for some unrelated reason, maybe in 5 years they'll find a solution to that unrelated reason. Maybe then we'll be in danger again. The U.S. passed a typically misnamed law called the USA Patriot Act last October. In a crushing blow against Americans' freedom. Described, of course, as an anti-terrorism measure. And part of the, one of the bad things in this bill is it makes it very easy for police to collect records from any business about its customers, including bookstores, for instance. And they're not allowed to tell anyone that this is happening. So I think the American Booksellers Association gave advice to bookstores about what they should do if they were subpoenaed to give out the records of what books somebody has bought, because the FBI is looking for people whose reading habits are suspicious. So it's really important to be able to buy your books anonymously. You know, don't order them with a credit card. Don't do it. It may seem convenient, but it's dangerous. Of course, ebooks, the usual scheme for ebooks is that they try to track who has them. So So, of course, that would imply that they wouldn't let you buy it anonymously with cash. You'd have to give your names to their records if you were going to buy e-books, encrypted, restricted e-books, that is. Now, the law that took away readers' traditional freedoms for e-books is called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Domination Millennium Copyright Act would be a better name for it. It essentially allows publishers to write their own copyright law as long as they implement it using technological means, for instance, based on encryption. It says that if the publishers build a system that imposes certain restrictions on you, then for you to bypass that is a crime. And for you to tell other people how to bypass that is a crime, too. So it's what we see now is that anything that can harm the publisher's profits is considered a crime. They are more important than you. And this law is already being used. For instance, movies published on DVD are stored in an encrypted format, which was secret. The purpose of keeping it secret was so that the movie companies could force all the DVD player manufacturers to stop you from exercising your legal rights in playing the DVDs that you had bought. For instance, they didn't want you to be able to skip over commercials, say. There were various restrictions they wanted. And so they said, we won't tell you how to build a DVD player unless you agree that your product will impose these restrictions. This was, in fact, before the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. But no one knew any other way to build a DVD player. Then a few people in Europe figured out the encryption and wrote a free software package called DECSS, which could read the contents of a DVD. And they released it under the GNU General Public License, the license that I wrote for the programs we were writing for the GNU system. And the people distributing this in the US were sued under the DMCA, and they were forced to stop. There are people who who made a version of the program short enough it could be printed on a t-shirt, and they're printing those t-shirts, and they're being sued. Somebody else set it to music, and he's being sued too. Meanwhile, the one member of the team whose name was disclosed to the public, who was 16 years old at the time, is facing prosecution in Norway, Jan Johansson, a hacker who did something for your freedom and is now being prosecuted because he liberated you from the restrictions that Hollywood wishes to impose on you. His defense needs help. If you know anyone in Norway, please urge that person to work on helping to support Jan Johansson. And I'm sad to say that the EU recently adopted a copyright directive that has restrictions similar to the DMCA. So the problem is coming here. The individual countries of the EU have a certain amount of leeway in how they implement the copyright directive. There are certain things that they can permit or prohibit. As you might expect, Blair is planning to implement the most restrictive imaginable way. But there may be some remote possibility that the government might still listen to public opinion on some issues, if public opinion speaks loud enough. So it's going to be up to you to make it speak. In the US, they're proposing further restrictions now. There's a bill that proposed by Senator Hollings, which we call it was called the SSSCA, and then I think they decided they didn't want anybody talking about it, so they renamed it to the CBDTPA. The way to remember that is it's the Consume But Don't Try Programming Act, because it says that all computers manufactured must have, in fact, anything that can copy, must have certain government-specified copy restriction circuitry in them. And connecting any computer which doesn't have this to the network would be prohibited as well. So free operating systems would be directly and immediately prohibited if this law goes into effect, which means, I guess, I will never be able to return to my country if this law goes into effect. I'll have to live in exile. Now, fortunately, it looks like there's not much support for passing that law. A lot of electronics companies don't like it. You know, the public interest isn't listened to, but when there are some companies on the other side, they get heard. However, there's a sort of mini CBDTPA, which is a bigger short-term danger. The movie companies, again, have said, we won't allow our movies to be played on digital TV unless everyone else adopts a system that will make it impossible for anyone to get the signal out for any equipment that we have not approved. And they have a sort of hand-picked standards group that they dominate called the Broadcast Protection Discussion Group, which has been working on designing the standard for this. And interestingly enough, it explicitly requires that the equipment be made such that it can't be, quote, tampered with, unquote, by the public. So it's designed so that you can't take it apart and modify it so that you can actually get the signal out. In other words, it can't be based on free software that lets you reinstall new software. So, in fact, it's what we see here is the first proposed law that would actually explicitly prohibit free software for certain jobs. The DMCA has been interpreted as prohibiting free software for a certain collection of very important jobs. Reading a DVD, listening to an encrypted audio stream, reading an e-book. Oh, a Russian programmer wrote a program that converted certain Adobe e-books into an open standard format. He did this in Russia where it was lawful. And then he visited the U.S. for a conference, and on his way out, he was arrested. Now, it used to be he was arrested for violating the DMCA by writing that program. Now, it used to be that it was Americans and other Westerners who had to be afraid when they visited the Soviet Union. Now, it's the other way around. But this is not an isolated occurrence. Today, the United States is the world leader in crushing unauthorized copying by the public. But the United States is not the first country to make a priority of this. The Soviet Union made strenuous efforts to stamp out forbidden copying, which was known as samizdat. And let's look at some of the methods that they used. First, they had guards watching each piece of copying equipment to check what you were going to copy so that you couldn't do forbidden copying. Second, they had harsh punishments. You could be sent to Siberia if you did it forbidden copying. Third, to help catch people, they asked everyone to inform on their coworkers and neighbors to the information police. Fourth, they used collective responsibility. You're going to watch that group. If I catch any of them doing forbidden copying, you are going to prison, so watch them carefully. And fifth, they use propaganda starting in childhood to convince you that only a vicious enemy of the people would ever do this forbidden copying. The United States, and increasingly other countries as well, are using all these same methods to crush forbidden copying. First, guards watching copying equipment. Well, in a copy store, that's exactly what the staff do. They check what you're going to copy. They won't let you do the copying that's forbidden. But using human labor to watch what you copy on your computer would be too expensive. So they're using robot guards. That's what the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is about. That's what the EU Copyright Directive is about, to make it a crime to remove or bypass those robot guards that control what you can do in your computer. Second, harsh punishments. Well, I already explained, it used to be not a crime at all, but now it can be a felony to copy things just to give them to your friends, even if you get nothing in return. And third, asking for informers. Well, in the US, there are ads on television, there are ads in the tube, ads all over the place, asking for people to rat on other people to the Business Software Alliance, which effectively acts like it's the information police. And they can be extremely vicious. In Argentina, they sent a letter threatening people with being raped in prison. They didn't use the words raped in prison, but the words they used were clear enough. And fourth, collective responsibility. Well, in the US, this has been done by conscripting internet service providers, making them legally responsible for what their customers post. And the only way that they can avoid this responsibility is if they have an invariable system of removing any material within 2 weeks of a complaint. I haven't seen the EU Copyright Directive, but it looks like the EU is moving in the same direction, and they just adopted a data retention directive that says countries can require telephone companies and ISPs, any kind of communication providers, to keep records on their customers' actions for years. And in the case of a cell phone, that would even include a complete track of everywhere you went. I don't have a cell phone. This is why. I don't feel like carrying around a tracking device. I hope that some of you will listen to this and resist getting cell phones before it becomes so universal that merely not having one is considered to make you suspect. Or shutting one off. Oh, why did you... Your Honor, he shut off his portable phone for these 3 hours. He must have been doing something wrong. It's the kind of argument that they will make once it becomes rare enough not to have a mobile phone on you that's turned on. And fifth, propaganda starting from childhood. That's what the word pirate is about. The word pirate used to be used by authors to describe publishers who had found some lawful way to publish an unauthorized edition. Now, it's being used by publishers to describe members of the public who share with each other. So it's essentially been turned around from a criticism of publishers to a way they express their assumption that they are entitled to total control over everything we do with a copyrighted work. So if you don't believe that making a copy of something for your friend is the moral equivalent of attacking a ship, I ask you not to say you believe it. Don't use the term pirate for that activity. You can call it by a neutral term. You can call it unauthorized copying, which describes what it is and expresses no opinion whatsoever. Or you can call it what I call it, sharing with your neighbor, which expresses a positive opinion. So, the publishers, through their power over legislatures, have been enacting laws to give themselves greater and greater power. At the same time, they've been treating the people who actually write the stuff like dirt. The clearest case is in the area of music, where at about the same time as the DMCA, the record companies got a law passed in the U.S. saying that the musicians, in many cases, didn't even have a copyright on their work, that it was work made for hire, which meant that the record companies would have permanent total power and could essentially dictate the terms to the musicians. Now, this, in fact, provoked an outcry and was later reversed. But still, even without that, the way record companies treat musicians is abominable. And this is important because, you see, when they demand more power over us, they say they're doing it for the sake of these creators. That's the word they like to use. It presents authors and musicians as semi-divine, so that we're supposed to feel that they deserve power over us and not object. And then, of course, the power is really exercised by the publishers. The record companies pay the musicians 4% of record sales. It's pretty small. And please note that that's an average. Of course, there are a few very successful musicians who get more than 4% of their own record sales. And since their own record sales are a large fraction, a disproportionate fraction of all record sales, what this shows is that the rest of the musicians are getting a lot less than 4% of their own record sales. Here's the way it works. If you're an aspiring musician, you're desperate to get a record contract. So the record company will offer you a contract where you have to give them 5 or 7 records until you have any chance of going elsewhere. And they say that and the terms under which you have to do this are very disadvantageous. Nominally, you get a certain amount of money for each record sold, but you don't really get that money because the publicity expenses are labeled as an advance. And so as some of your records are sold, the money that's nominally your share is really going to pay back the publicity expenses, and you don't get it. This is why you often see musicians selling their own records at their concerts. Because if they sell you the record at their own concerts, they get the retailer's share, which is probably bigger, and they really get it. Whereas the share that's nominally theirs, they are probably never going to see. Now, when I buy a commercially produced CD, I feel ashamed because I know I'm not supporting the musicians. I would feel much better in my conscience if I had an easy way to just copy the music and send some money to those musicians, because then I'd feel I was supporting them. I am an amateur musician. I'm not all that good at it, but I can respect the people who are. And because of that, I'm disgusted by the idea of a music industry. The music industry takes in huge supplies of hype and presses it into hits. I love music. I don't want my music to be manufactured out of hype. I want my music to be produced by artists who are doing it, who are doing what they love. And because of that, I would like the music factories to disappear. And I think we'd all be better off if that happened. Now, the musicians do benefit in a certain way from these record contracts, unfair as they are. They get publicity. After all, the record company spends money on publicity, and that has some effect. More people hear their music, and more people may want to go to their concerts. So in fact, they may make some money indirectly because more people are going to their concerts, and they get to give more concerts at better places and so on. So they get various kinds of benefits, including perhaps making a living, through the effects of the publicity. But that's not the only way musicians can get publicity. They can get publicity through people copying their music on the internet. In other words, instead of saying that musicians are going to get publicity through the efforts of record companies and then condemning music sharing over the internet because it interferes with the record companies doing this, we can make the internet be the ally of the musicians. We can say, go ahead, everybody, copy music over the internet. As long as it's non-commercial, you're welcome to. And they will then tell other people about the music that they like. And they'll say, ah, I heard this great song. Let me mail it to you. And musicians that appeal to people will get publicized this way. And they'll get the same benefits that they get now. So I think that this system would work just as well for doing the job that copyright is supposed to do for musicians, and which it right now does abominably. For books, the situation is not quite as abominable. The behavior of book publishers is not quite as abominable. But it's still pretty bad. I read a rather sad article by somebody who'd written a book which had actually been in print for over 20 years, which is pretty good in this day and age. And he had ended up making a rather small amount of money, which he'd sold many thousands of copies. And he ended up making, I think it was 50 cents a copy, which would be something like maybe 30p a copy. And instead of recognizing that the system had shafted him, he couldn't think of anything to do except ask people not to share copies and just to go buy the book, even though the amount he was apparently going to get if they did was minuscule. Most books, however, are not in print for 20 years. Most books in the US, and I suspect here as well, are out of print in 3 years. And probably remaindered before that. And so it occurs to me that perhaps we should shorten the term of copyright to 10 years, which is still much longer than most books remain in print. So for most books, it won't change anything really. Ah, by the way, here's how the book publishers are trying to shaft the authors in whose name they demand these powers. Most book contracts say that if the book goes out of print, the rights revert to the author, who can then dispose of them again as he or she sees fit. But the publishers are trying to claim that because of e-books or print-on-demand services, that the book will never go out of print, and therefore that they never have to return the rights. So it's important to remember, the same companies that claim to be cracking the whip in the name of the authors are treating the authors like dirt. Now, when we consider what an intelligent copyright system would do today, we have to start by rejecting the assumption of uniformity. Publishers loved asking us to adopt a uniform system. They say, copyright rules have to be the same for all kinds of works. Well, in fact, they're not. There are a lot of exceptions for music. And there are a lot of other complicated rules, too. Copyright is a rather complicated and non-uniform system already. Why do they ask us to treat uniformity as a goal? The reason is this. Once we agree to that assumption of uniformity, then they can pick some rare case and say, in this rare case, if copyright power didn't extend this far, it might not be enough incentive. And so then they say, well, then it copyright power has to extend this far for everything. So they can essentially use these weird cases built on a pile of what-ifs to argue for more power everywhere. But actually, we don't have to dispute those what-ifs. We can just point out that there's no reason for uniformity. Why adopt a rule that you are going to pay the same price for everything you buy? I'm going to buy things only for the price of £1,000. So if you're going to buy a carton of milk, you have to pay £1,000. If you're going to buy a car, you have to pay £1,000. Well, they wouldn't sell you a car for £1,000, a new one. But basically, you can see it's a stupid. So they would argue, well, £1,000 isn't enough. You have to increase it to £10,000. Okay, now you're paying £10,000 for your carton of milk because you've made this stupid assumption that the price you pay for everything has to be the same. If we're giving up our freedom to get some benefit, in effect, the freedom we're giving up is a price we're paying. Why should it be the same for everything? An intelligent bargain would have us give up different amounts of freedom depending on what kind of thing it was we're buying. And I've identified three broad classes of works that I think need to be considered separately. Divided not according to the media, but according to the kind of purpose they serve, the way in which they are useful to society. First, there are functional works, works which you use to do a job. Second, there are works that represent someone, that say what certain parties saw, thought, believe, want, or whatever. And finally, there are the aesthetic or entertaining works, where the purpose of the work is simply the sensation you get when you partake of it. Now, in the case of functional works, these include computer programs, recipes, manuals, and more generally textbooks, reference works such as dictionaries and encyclopedias, and maybe other things as well. These, I believe, ought to be free. You should have the freedom to use them in a wide range of ways, even going so far as commercially publishing a modified version, because it's useful. You see, when a work does a job, this has certain consequences. For instance, I might write a work to do one job, and you might have in mind a job that's different but partly overlaps, and you might find it's useful to start with what I wrote and modify it to do your job. And then you might want to publish this because there may be other people who have jobs like yours. Or even if your job is the same as mine, you might have a better idea for how to do that job. So you might just want to make an improved version for the same purpose. After all, just because I'm the one who did it first, that doesn't mean I got everything right. Doesn't mean you won't see something that I missed. For all these different kinds of works that do jobs, that people use them to do a job, this is always true. People are going to find it useful, and society will find it useful if people are publishing modified versions. And you may often get hundreds or even thousands of people contributing. I recently learned that 3,000 people have contributed to the GNU C library alone. And that may not, and they may not all be individuals. Some of them are corporations. Now, this means that this means that for functional works, essentially there will be no copyright system creating an artificial incentive to develop them. Fortunately, we now have enough observation to show we don't really need one, because first, in free software, we see hundreds of thousands of people developing free software and large numbers of programs, broad spectrums of programs being developed. And we are now starting to see it take off in other areas as well. The free encyclopedias are growing rapidly, and we are now seeing more free manuals for free software, including commercially published free manuals. Remember, free refers to freedom. It doesn't mean that copies must not have a price. In fact, I developed a license called the GNU Free Documentation License, which is designed to make it to facilitate companies making money by selling printed copies of free manuals. And a number of manuals have been published under that license. We publish our manuals. Here I brought a few of them under that license. But also, O'Reilly Associates has published a few books under the GNU Free Documentation License, which means that you can go to a store and buy those books, and you're supporting the author even. But you also have freedom. And we're beginning to see the development of free textbooks in other areas. I've heard of three free dictionary projects, one being a dictionary of Walloon. Also, there's a Spanish dictionary, free dictionary project. And there's a free dictionary project for translation between Indian languages, which is enough to show that it can be done. And I expect to see more in the future. And if the Supreme Court rejects the Copyright Extension Act, we'll put the OED online and ask people to start updating it. And second, let's come to the area of works that represent certain parties. These include memoirs, essays of opinion, scientific papers. After all, a scientific paper reports on what you saw when you did an experiment. Offers to buy and sell, catalogs of merchandise, and probably other kinds of things. So, to modify a work whose purpose is to say what certain people saw or thought is not a socially useful thing to do. There's no reason why we should make sure people have the freedom to publish modified versions of essays of opinion or modified versions of scientific papers. I'd say you shouldn't do that. You should publish them as they were written so as to accurately represent what so-and-so thought. So this means that it's sufficient if people have the right to do verbatim copying and redistribution. And this has a further consequence, because there's no crucial reason why everyone should have the freedom to commercially publish these verbatim copies. We could have a sort of compromise level copyright system which permits everyone to do non-commercial verbatim copying and redistribution. But copyright would still cover all commercial use and all modification of these works. Now, this compromise level copyright system has a virtue that it gets rid of the worst aspects of the copyright system today. It becomes an industrial regulation again, just as copyright was in the age of the printing press. No more need to intrude into everyone's home to catch all the so-called pirates who are sharing with their neighbors. That would be lawful. It's only commercial activity, which in general would be visible, that would be restricted. It would be an industrial regulation again. Now, this might not produce as large a revenue stream as today's system. Who knows? Maybe it would be almost as large. Might even be larger. There's some indication that allowing non-commercial copying increases the interest in a work. Finally, there's the hardest issue, which is the entertaining or aesthetic works. And the thing that makes it hard is the issue of modified versions, because although some authors and musicians like to say that their personal integrity is present in the work and that anyone else changing it would mess it up, we see that there is a folk process, and the folk process can improve things. It can, through many people changing the same work, lead to something very rich. And then if we want to look at named and famous artists, consider Shakespeare, who copied the basic plots for some plays from other plays. Of course, the details of his plays were very different, but it would still be copying infringement under today's laws, and therefore he might not have been allowed to make some of his great plays. And then to pick an example that's newer and not nearly so great, but rather popular, consider Star Wars: The Phantom Menace, a movie I have not seen because I had reason to think it wasn't worth it. Somebody apparently got a digital copy of this and edited it and produced Star Wars: The Phantom Edit, which people say is superior to the original. must be rather embarrassing for whoever, what's his name? Well, I guess now he's going to campaign for making sure that nobody can ever do this again and show him up again. So what this says is we shouldn't, for the sake of the progress of culture, which is what copyright is supposed to serve, we shouldn't prevent all these modified versions of aesthetic works. We should leave some way for them to be done. Now, it could be that we won't get thousands of people contributing to one very often, or thousands of independent teams. In making a movie, maybe thousands of people can work on it, but they're working together under one organization. So it doesn't create a problem of, we don't need a system to adjudicate who should get how much money. They just work that out through their contracts. The place where we have an issue is somebody makes a modified version of some other work and wants to publish it. How do you divide up whatever money they're going to have? If you're going to have a copyright system such that there's going to be a revenue stream for the artists, how do you apportion things? How do you work things out in the case of modified versions of something already published? It doesn't work to just say, negotiate it before you publish the modified version, because then they often won't be able to agree. So that just becomes an obstacle. That's the system we have now. You have to get permission, and often you just can't. So we need some kind of system where they didn't have to agree, but if we wanted to use copyright to support these artists, we'd have to apportion the money somehow. Well, if typically the number of independently working artists responsible for any given version is fairly small, we can figure that there could be some kind of arbitration board which could do this and could have, and they might be able to do a reasonable job if the cases don't get too complicated. If they got too complicated, like with 3,000 different people, all of whom were independently working on the GNU-C library, no such scheme could make any sense at all. For software, it would be hopeless to try to have an automatic legal system for deciding who should get royalties. It's hopeless. But maybe it'll work for novels. Maybe it'll work for music if the situations don't become as complicated as they are for software. Whether that will be true, I don't know. So this is an unsolved problem. It's clear that people should have at least the freedom to make verbatim non-commercial copies and redistribute that way. The hard part becomes, how do we arrange for modified versions to be available? And they should be available. Well, that's an interesting question. I've come to the end now of my first talk, Copyright versus Community. And I could ask for questions at this point, but I think it might be, I think I could ask for questions, say, for 15 minutes and then go on to the other talk. People want me to do that? What do people think? A break would be a very bad idea, because a lot of people would leave. I've held you spellbound. I've held you spellbound, but if we break the spell with a break, then half of you will leave, and what good will the other speech do? Only half as much good. In fact, this convinces me I should go straight on into the other speech and then ask for questions at the end.